Right. Thanks very much, Dave. I hope you all enjoy our scribbly notes there. But what I like is when David says things, it brings other things into your mind. So when he was talking about the last times and suddenly that famous song, I Wish We'd All Been Ready, came to mind, which only those over 55 will remember, I guess. But I actually asked David a question some time ago, and I'll start him off with this one, because it jumped out. So I'm being told to stand near, David.
I'm ready.
Right, this question actually jumped out of something where I was reading Matthew, and I was reading Matthew chapter 11 for a specific purpose, and my focus was on verse 28, which you all know, it says, "Come to me, all you that are weary and heavy laden." And when I read it, because somebody asked me to preach on that, and I hate just having verses, you have to look at the whole picture. And as I looked at the whole picture, I was a bit struggling with it, because it looked as though this just wasn't in the right place to me. And when David said he was going to do Matthew, I said to him, well, how about this one then, David? And he said,
right, yes. How does that fit in? It does seem a bit strange, doesn't it? It doesn't quite seem to fit together. But actually, it fits in quite well, because it follows on from what Jesus has just been doing. He's been having a difficult time in this chapter, has Jesus. And he's just been denouncing the towns where he has been preaching, because they had decided they weren't interested in turning to him. These places where he'd been living for years, the people who he'd known, had decided he wasn't the Messiah. And of course that devastated him, because he knew what that would mean for them. But at the same time, he's praising God from hiding these things from the wise and learned and giving them to the nobodies, the people who would be pushed around, the people who'd be told they weren't keeping their laws properly. And that's why, after saying, "You've revealed these things to little children, then no one knows the Father except the Son, and no one knows the Son except the Father." And he goes on to talk about, "Come to me, you who are weary and burdened." What he's actually saying is, I don't want you to carry a great big yoke on your shoulders anymore. Come to me and you can walk with me with my yoke. You see, a yoke drawn by oxen would be carried by two people, one in front, one behind. So Jesus is actually saying, come to me and carry my yoke. And it actually fits in very well with what he's been saying about following him and what following him would mean, even when lots of people of his time weren't that interested. Does that help to answer your question?
Yeah, that certainly helps, David. Samuel's got his hand up. Here you are, Samuel.
It ties in when you were actually talking about the Jesus saying what might have been considered upside down. It ties in with a lot of the culture at that time, because at the time, it was based on rank. Your status is based on rank and your position in the society at the time. Whereas Jesus is actually showing that actually your status isn't important. Actually, I'm giving all this to the lowly. But what I'm also interested in is, why does Matthew put that bit in about the Gentile woman in his gospel?
Right. Yes, the Gentile, but let's do that first, because it's a hint. Matthew knows he has to be careful how he explains to Jewish people that the gospel is actually for the world. And so instead of actually saying, yes, it is for the world, he decides to drop people a few little hints to make them actually see it happen. The most obvious one is actually the centurion's servant, because the centurion who wants Jesus to heal his servant actually says to Jesus, just say the word and my servant will be healed. I've seen you. I know that you have authority. Because I'm a soldier, And I know what authority looks like. I have people under me and I have officers over me. And that amazes Jesus so much. He says, I've never seen people in Israel with this great faith. And even though his message is still to Israel, when the Canaanite woman comes and shows she does have the faith that Jesus can do what she is asking, that's why he says, yes, I'll do it, and heals her. It's a hint that Jesus' message is for the world, but at the moment, it's still for Israel. And Matthew has to be careful how he does that, because if he's too strong on it, even Jewish people who were Christians won't like it. You see in the book of Acts how difficult some believers found accepting that the message of God was for Gentiles who weren't circumcised and didn't know the law of Moses.
Oh, you've got a couple of hands up over here.
Hi, David, it's Val here. I want to ask a question about chapter 10, Matthew 10, mm-hmm. about the instructions to the disciples, and where he says in 10:5, these 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions. Does that mean the disciples left Jesus when he went into Galilee?
You're asking, did they actually go out?
Yes.
Well, they must have done, because he wouldn't have given the instructions if he didn't.
And how did they come back together again, or don't
it
we know that?
It doesn't say, because that's not the point of the story. Matthew's not going to tell you that, because the point is what Jesus taught them, not what they did next.
Right. Hi, David, it's Jane here. Where did Matthew find the two prophecies about Jesus? I'm thinking it must have been in the Torah. And do you think as Christians we ought to read the Torah?
Of course we should read Torah. It's the Old Testament. If no, you don't...
there's obviously more, isn't there, than what we have got in the Old Testament and the New Testament. Is there? Or am I off one here? Which is not unusual.
Sorry, I don't quite understand the question. I'm afraid you'll have to be a bit clearer.
I might be able to help a little bit there. What Matthew does is that he often puts little bits of Old Testament quotes together to make another quote. So you think that he's quoting a whole passage, but he's actually stitching together bits. And also some of the things that he quotes would be a different way of it being written, because obviously language has changed over time, and the version of the Torah that he'd be referring to wouldn't put things quite the same way as our translation would. So I think that often is an answer as to why he quotes something you can't find it. But that's my understanding of how the differences.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, this is actually, I did want to talk about this, but I was conscious of time, especially when Bernie tapped me on the shoulder to tell me I'd had half an hour. And that there's so much in here which you just don't have time to get into in 45 minutes. Is Matthew cherry picking when he does that with the gospel, with the Old Testament? We do actually need to look at the Old Testament and see where he's getting it from. But we then need to ask ourselves, what's he doing with this? Why is he putting it in there? Sometimes it's an actual prophecy that makes sense, like the virgin will be with child. Okay, that one's obvious. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and he shall be called Emmanuel. Another one, which is less obvious, is Hosea. Out of Egypt I called my son. And you're going, eh? What's that got to do with anything? Because if you read it, you will see that that's got nothing to do with Jesus, and it isn't even a prophecy. What Matthew's doing there is he is applying the Old Testament to Jesus. You can look at that and see how he's doing it, because that is what rabbis and Jewish teachers did. But note of caution, if you want to do it, please, please, please be careful. Please, please, please think about it and pray about it. And never do it to try to explain a political event, because I guarantee you're likely to get it wrong. Even I don't want to do that, because I'm pretty sure I'll get it wrong.
David, it's Janet Mann here. Could you explain to me, as an ignoramus, that how the Torah is made up? Obviously, it's the Pentateuch, isn't it? And some of the Psalms, but what else?
That's basically the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch and the Torah are the same kind of thing, and it's the first five books of the Bible. So that's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. That's what those five are. And that is why Matthew has deliberately chosen five teaching blocks to build his gospel around. So you've got five books of the law, you've got five teachings of Jesus. This is Matthew's way of saying Jesus is the Messiah. But to answer your question, that's how Torah is made up. Torah is the first five books of the Bible. There are lots and lots of other complicated Hebrew names for different parts of the Old Testament because Jewish people don't see it the same way as we do. I mean, personally, I don't actually like calling it the Old Testament that much. I'm doing it here because you guys know what I'm talking about, but it makes it sound like it's not relevant. And I have a problem with that idea. So I like to call them the Hebrew scriptures, but it doesn't really matter.
Sitting next to Janet is Ernie. Just a little point, David. Something I happened to read sometime. One of the reasons that I think that Matthew was writing to the Gentiles, because many of the synagogues actually had a lot of fellow travellers there. There were a lot of Gentiles in the synagogues. And there are some examples of those actually in the scriptures, of actually people that were with the Jews. So there was a concern that his message was wider. And of course, God's desire was it to be much wider than that. So just that little point. The second one, I think, you actually said, unless you put God at the top of the list, get out. And I understand what you're saying, but that's a very hard statement. I believe, and this is what, you know, we tend to believe here, I believe, is that people come into the church, they see how wonderful fellowship and how marvellous we all are, the teaching works in their lives, and they give their life to Jesus. Now, I actually gave my life in one moment there, but I know many people who actually, I've almost used the phrase, drift into the kingdom, and that's marvellous. God doesn't mind how you become a Christian. He wants you to give your life to the Lord Jesus. So just a little point, you perhaps didn't mean that, but that's what I think is important.
I just say that Matthew wasn't writing to Gentiles. He was actually definitely writing to Jewish believers. But yes, you did have Gentiles in the synagogues. The Jewish people would call them God-fearers. And that means someone who's not quite become a Jew, but someone who is interested in Judaism and is trying to understand it better. The Ethiopian eunuch in the book of Acts was a God-fearer. The centurion, who we meet in Matthew and in Luke, was probably also a God-fearer. They say he built the synagogue. I mean, a cynic would say he did that to keep the Jewish people happy. But he probably, because he had to settle with these Jews and he had to live with them and he wasn't in the army anymore, he probably was actually investigating it. As for the second bit, no, God doesn't mind how you become a Christian. But I think the point is, if we're too concerned about being inclusive and making sure everyone in the church feels happy and comfortable and welcomed, we forget the fact that sometimes the gospel is actually offensive. At some point, everyone is going to find something in Jesus' message offensive. If they don't, that means you're looking at the wrong gospel. I'm sorry, but it really does. Because that is what God's message is. It's a message that changes you. It's not a message you can pick and choose from. You either accept it or you're not interested at the end of the day.
Right, back to Samuel, I think.
Have you got anything online while Samuel asked the question?
No, we haven't.
So okay.
Gail had a question, but you answered it during...
Okay, we'll do Samuel first, then we'll have Gail.
Yes, it's interesting what you said, because this is the thing. Jews would have been offended by what Jesus said. In fact, we tend to forget during when we look at Jesus' words that he was very offensive. He would actually, even nowadays, be called bigoted. So that you're right. He would have offended a lot of people. And you're right that we need to change. Jesus accepts us for who we are, but he does require us to change. Otherwise, we become more progressive, for want of a better word, where the idea is you don't, where you just change, where you don't change at all. You just stay as you are.
Yeah. Well, Jesus says to the adulterous woman, "Go and don't sin again." When the rich young ruler can't give up his wealth, Jesus doesn't say, "Oh, never mind, never mind. Follow me anyway. You know, it doesn't matter. We can forget about that." He says, "Children, how hard it is for the rich to enter the kingdom of God." And yeah, Jesus. We don't often realize this. Jesus was extremely offensive to Jewish people. He's saying he's greater than the temple. He's saying he's essentially the one they should be obeying instead of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And that would have been a real shock. And worst of all, he's not giving them the kind of kingdom they want. They want a kingdom that says, if someone forces you to go with him 1 mile, you should kill him. Jesus says, if someone forces you to go with him 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Actually, I'll just say very quickly, that is also a particular saying. In Roman times, a Roman-occupied Israel, a soldier could force you to carry his pack for him, but he could only force you to do it for 1 mile. So when Jesus says, go with him 2 miles, that's going to scare the soldier witnesses. If he is caught doing that, he'll be in very big trouble. So it's not just saying, lie down and take it. It's saying, fight back, but not in the way I'm telling, not in the way you're expected to fight back.
Hi, David. If I can go back slightly to something we touched on before, the way that Matthew writes, it seems to me that it's more almost a collection of remembered incidents, particularly I've noticed in chapter 8, where it's written like a narrative, but it clearly isn't, because each little story, if you like, that he puts in there, it says when or then, but actually the bits don't follow on from each other at all. Whereas maybe in Luke and Mark, you get this sense of Jesus did this, then he did this, then he did that. With Matthew, you haven't actually got that link between all those bits. Matthew is writing very much to make a point, to write a section of material that tells you something, rather than the way that we would tend to understand reading a book about somebody, where they do this, then they do that, and then they do that.
I agree. Again, this was something I wanted to touch on, but didn't have time to go into in depth. It's very much a case that Matthew has collected these stories, he's collected these teachings, and he's put them into sections, and then he tells you them. I don't think Jesus actually preached the whole Sermon on the Mount at once. I think it's far more likely these were things he taught over a number of years. Matthew's remembered them, and he's put them together. And he's put them down there so they're all in one place. He's got a group of stories that tell a point. Matthew chapter 8, Jesus has authority. What stories do I have, thinks Matthew, that shows Jesus have authority? Let me see. Now there's the healing of the leper, and there's the squall at sea, and there's the centurion servant. I'll put them all down here together, and that way people will get the point I'm trying to make. That was what Matthew was more interested in. In Jewish writings, they were far more interested in making a point than they were in telling you the story, which is annoying for us because we want the story. And they're going, no, the story's not interesting. The point's interesting. I want a story. No, the story's not important. The if and when and why isn't really that important. The point is, what did they say?
Any other questions?
We better have Gail's one.
Michael here. Thank you for your treatment of Matthew. Great. I want to ask a question. I can remember Peter Guinness once talking about the ride into Jerusalem and how the disciples were praising him, When Jesus was arrested and condemned, it wasn't the same crowd that actually shouted, "Crucify, crucify."
No, it wasn't. It wasn't.
And you believe that, yeah? Because some people say, well, you know, they just turned and it was the same people, but it couldn't have been. You believe the second?
Honestly, I don't, because, you know, when he rides into Jerusalem, you have Jerusalem saying, "Who is this guy?" And the Pharisees themselves didn't want the arrest to happen during the feast, because if the people found out that's what had happened, there'd be trouble. People who say it's the same crowd are usually trying to make a point. And that point is an accurate point, which is you can't rely on public opinion. They'll be backing you one day, and the next minute they'll want your head on a platter.
Yeah.
And that is true. You can't rely on public opinion. People are very fickle. But that's not what this story is about. This story is actually about the priests and the Pharisees getting rid of Jesus. And I do have to say here that the Pharisees and the priests were very, very corrupt. Most of what Jesus said about them, I think, there would have been Pharisees in the crowd who would have been cheering him on. There would have been Pharisees listening to the Sermon on the Mount who said, "About time somebody said that." There would be Pharisees listening to him condemning the temple and condemning its hypocrisy and saying, "Thank goodness, someone's actually standing up to these people and telling them how it is." But those same people would not have liked his claim that he was the Messiah. And we do have to accept that. That's not anti-Semitic. That's just the truth, that it would have been such an alien concept. Bernie, I think we better have Gail's question so I can answer it.
Sorry, David. No, what I was saying was that Gail did have a question before you started, but you answered it in your teaching.
Oh, all right then.
So that's fine. And there's nothing else I see on the Facebook.
Okay.
I was going to add to what you were saying there that, of course, the people who shouted Hosanna and put palm trees down, leaves down for Jesus, of course, these were people who were coming from outside into Jerusalem for the festival.
Mm.
They were people, a lot of them probably came from the area that Jesus had been teaching in. So a lot of them would have a good idea of who Jesus was. And obviously they had a sense that at this point, Jesus was going to come and make a statement. He was going to kick Romans out or whatever. But of course, the cronies that the high priest and the leadership of in Jerusalem had would not have been those people. There would have been people who lived in Jerusalem. There'd be people they had contacts with and who had other contacts. So when you think about the actual situation, you can see that it would be very unlikely that it was the same people who praised Jesus who were the ones who wanted him crucified.
Yeah. I mean, I'd just say the people who were really supposed to be running the temple were the Sadducees. And you will see in chapter of Matthew where they tried to ask him trick questions. The Sadducees had turned up with a silly question about the resurrection. They were trying to prove the resurrection was such a daft idea that no one in their right mind would believe it was true. And what Jesus actually is saying is, you are the rulers of the temple, the high priest is a Sadducee, and you're telling me you don't understand the resurrection. He doesn't say that, but actually that is what he's saying. How can you call yourself representatives of God if you don't even understand the resurrection and you've got this completely backwards?
Okay, any other questions? I think you've baffled everyone. Oh, here you are. As he's quickly lost it. Okay. Technology. Gail says, Matthew 11:12, what does it mean the kingdom of heaven has been subjected to violence and violent people have been raiding it? What was Jesus talking about?
Yeah, that's an odd verse, actually. I haven't quite satisfied myself with what Jesus is trying to say there, I have to admit. The context of it, though, is talking about John. And I think the point he's making is the kingdom of heaven is shoving its way in, whether you like it or not, and other people don't want that happening. There will be opposition, there will be struggles, there will be trouble. That is the best answer I can give at the moment, because I'm not fully satisfied myself about what that verse means.
Graham, I think, is just going to answer it. No. Mike.
It's Michael here. There is, I remember reading a Hebrew scholar, I can't remember his name now, but he reckons that the Hebrew, for some of the words on that passage, can be confused with another word, and it comes across in a different way. I can't give you the details at the moment, but it makes more sense if you interpret a particular Hebrew word in that passage differently, and it will come across in a very different way. But I could find it out later, but I remember reading that, which for me, you know, makes more sense.
Okay, any other questions? No? Hey, David, looks like it's over for you now.
Yeah.
Except...
just to say quickly, I don't know what's happening in Bible Stream in July, so you guys...